Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. When a teenager vanishes from her Adirondack summer camp, two worlds collide. Liz Moore transports readers into a thrilling drama richly set against summertime in the Adirondack Mountains. Rich in intricate plotting and alive with emotional heft, the God of the Woods follows the mysteries of a dynastic family, an American family, the secrets of the summer camp nestled in their estate, the tragic history of a blue-collar community, and the disappearance of a young girl at the center of it all. Liz Moore is the author of the New York Times best-selling novel Long Bright River, which was a Good Morning America Book Club pick, and one of Barack Obama's favorite books of the year until this year, and then he chose The God of the Woods as his favorite, one of his favorite books of 2024. It is a great pleasure to welcome to a live audience at the Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs, New York, Liz Moore.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks, Joe.
Well, thank you. The name of the book, The God of the Woods, it is an absolutely glorious novel. Did you have any sense that this was going to take off the way it did? The fact that it just became everyone's required summer reading, and wherever you went into any independent bookstore or any library, they said, oh, have you read Liz Moore's new book? People dream about that. What was that like for you?
Wonderful is the short answer, but I have had a very, the opposite of a steep arc of success as an author, because this is actually my fifth novel, and so the first three that I wrote were quiet. They, you know, just not like The God of the Woods, and so I think I've had a long on-ramp to process many emotions about being an author, so this feels good.
Yeah, I would think it would. Now, the last book was very successful, and then this book comes out, but it's something about the book, it's something about the subject, it's your exquisite writing that strikes a chord with people, and I'm wondering if you have come to terms with what that possibly could be.
Oh, why do people like my books is the question. I don't know. I mean, one thing that I have become more and more interested in as I've gone on as a writer is finding ways to tell what I hope is a really good story, but also addresses broader social themes. And so in The God of the Woods, certainly it's a mystery. It's actually a dual mystery where two different children go missing at two different periods of time. But if I did my job right, it also tackles issues like income inequality or sexism or the women's movement in the 1970s. And I don't know, maybe people have something to talk about as well.
And none of that is overt in the sense of you think about tackling those subjects. They come naturally within the course of writing the novel.
Yeah, I never write to a particular theme, but over the course of writing a first draft of a manuscript, I start to understand what I'm interested in exploring. Like another way to ask that question is, why am I writing this book now, at this moment in history? And the answer usually comes back to me because I'm exploring some theme that feels topical now. So income inequality, for example, is a theme that feels, even though the book is set in the 1970s, it resonates with me at least today.
There's always a point where when I'm reading, there's a point where you fall in love. And when I'm reading, there's a point where I just fall in love with a novel. For yours, it was page 13. 12, page 12. And it was this sentence that got me. You had me at this sentence.
Okay, I'm ready.
Her father once told her casually that she was built like a plum on toothpicks. And the phrase was at once so cruel and so poetic that it clicked into place around her like a harness. That is gorgeous.
Thank you.
It's really beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm interested in how truly cruel phrases can have just a little bit of poetry to them sometimes as well.
How long does that take? Is that natural? I mean, I would love to say, well, I just, I knock that out.
That particular sentence?
Yes.
Well, if I'm in a rhythm of writing, which doesn't happen most of the time, I would say 95 to 6% of the time that I'm writing, it feels like labor. But for the other 5% of the time, it does, you get into a rhythm or a flow and things occur to you when you're in that zone. That's probably a sentence that occurred to me when I was in that zone in some way. And it feels good, and it feels like you're communing with your subconscious in a way that is what makes writing worth it, ultimately.
And this is about Tracy, mm-hmm. who's a young girl who has gone to this camp. Mm-hmm. What made you set something in a camp in the Adirondack Mountains?
I have a long family history in the Adirondacks. So my mother's ancestors moved to the southern Adirondacks in the early 1800s to form family farms. And about a century later, a public works project displaced them from the Adirondacks to just south of the Adirondacks. So my grandmother was born and raised in Ballston Lake, New York, not mm-hmm. too far away. And my mother was raised in Schenectady. And my grandmother was still alive. She lived into her 90s. She was 96 when she died. So I was very close with her. We also have a camp in the southern Adirondacks that is much different than the Van Laar Preserve, than the house called Self-Reliance. It is essentially, it is not doing well. It's slowly falling apart. It's quite, you know, it's modest, but it's beautiful, and the land is gorgeous, and, you know, so I have a strong emotional pull to this area.
When you look at the idea of just this 6 million acre park mm-hmm. and how it can have so many secrets and yet be so explored by so many. Mm-hmm. And that's what seems to be fascinating, because even the people who inhabit the novel are still coming to terms with this place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real majesty to the land around here, north of here in the Adirondack Park. And that, I love the duality. Actually, you know Anne LaBastille?
Yes.
Do you all know Anne LaBastille?
The Woods Woman.
The Woods Woman, yeah. I read Woods Woman and then one other book in that series. And I was just really taken with Anne LaBastille, who was a conservationist and a writer and somebody who lived on her own in a remote part of the Adirondacks for many years. And she has this quote that actually became one of the epigraphs of the God of the Woods, which is about how you can find beauty and peril in the wilderness. And they are inextricable from one another, and they form two parts of a whole. And that was kind of my guiding ethos for The God of the Woods as I was writing it.
Liz Moore is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The God of the Woods. You said a moment ago about the double mystery and what makes the disappearance of this young woman is that, especially concerning, as this had happened before, and this had happened before within the same family. Mm-hmm. And so that gives you a lot to work with, doesn't it, as far as the reverberations of that mm-hmm. with what is unfolding in the moment.
Yeah, some would say too much. I would have said too much when I. So the
who said too much?
I, my own inner monologue when I
okay.
when I was writing the novel, the disappearance of Barbara, which is the first thing we learn about in the novel, was the only thing I had in mind to write a book about. I knew that there would be a wealthy family who had a mansion in the wilderness, essentially a great camp in the Adirondacks. I knew they would have founded a summer camp just down the hill. I knew they sent their own daughter to the summer camp, and I knew that daughter would disappear, but I didn't know anything else about the novel. It was in exploring the backstory of the characters and trying to ask myself, like, why they are the way they are, that it occurred to me that maybe an earlier tragedy could have existed in their family, and that's when the story of Bear came to me as well. Anytime a thought like that occurs to me a third of the way into a manuscript, I try very hard to resist it because I have a tendency to write long books, and this is no different. This book is almost 500 pages long, and so I really struggled against that instinct until I lost the fight, and I said, this really is a dual mystery, and I went with it, and that's how the book was formed.
Which would make sense if it wasn't so key and it all comes together mm-hmm. to a point where it fulfills everything that you want, right? I mean, it's what gives the novel its heft and its arc and its scope.
Yeah, it does. It's hard to imagine it without the earlier disappearance at this point. But yeah, that was later in the process that I came to sort of include that earlier mystery.
There's a scene in the book where the first child has gone missing. The mother is giving birth to a second child. Mm-hmm. And you write, and this is as the nurses are in the delivery room, over and over again, she wailed his name, Bear, Bear, and the name itself became a chant or incantation, assumed all of its many meanings at once, abide, endure, sustain, accept, convey, bring forth, give birth to. Did you always know that the character would be Bear? I mean, which does that come first, and then you're able to write that gorgeous sentence?
The name came first, and yeah. Then as I was writing that scene, I am really interested in the etymology of words, which is maybe evident from the title of the book. Can I go there at this juncture about the title of the book?
Sure.
So the God of the Woods also came out of my exploration of the etymology of a different word, which is panic. And then the bigger word is wood panic, which is a real word used to describe the real phenomenon of feeling very, very lost or disoriented when surrounded by trees, because the trees all start to look the same. And when I was searching for a title for this book, I investigated the etymology of the word panic alone and discovered that it comes from the Greek god Pan, who is said to be a god of the woods. And so from there, the phrase just took on a lot of different points of, it intersects with so many characters and themes in the book that it felt right.
The intersection of this very rich family, which, by the way, you don't make sound very much fun.
I know. For all their money, they don't have that much fun. You're right.
No, this. But then the intersection with the town, mm-hmm. and these are the people who are there year round, mm-hmm. and that's a fascinating thing to explore because of the remoteness. That's a tough life. Mm-hmm.
The town in question is called Shattuck, which is a fictional town, although somebody did, actually at an event I did at Northshire, somebody asked me if it was based on Shattagay. It is not. That is a sonic coincidence. Shattuck is a town that I conceived of to be like many small towns in remote places. When I think about my own ancestors, they lived in an even more remote place probably than the way that Shattuck is described, and had to contend with a lot of different, you know, societal and natural forces that made their existence pretty difficult, presumably. Anytime I can put very, very different characters together in fiction and let them intersect and interact, I love to do that because it creates a kind of natural narrative tension. People coming from very different life circumstances, when you put them together in a room, it is rare that they will immediately gel. And that's a great gift for a fiction writer.
For the audience listening to us on the radio at home, you have a map that you include in the book. Mm-hmm. And it is... I found it to be very useful. Did you have this while you were writing?
Yeah, I drew that for myself, an earlier version of that, just to keep straight the geography of the land as I wrote it. And it ended up, I sent it along with the manuscript to my editor, and I don't remember if it was her idea or somebody else at Riverhead's idea, but it ended up making its way into the front matter of the book as well.
And it's helpful because it shows the fact that there is this place that is so close to a home called Self-Reliance. Mm-hmm. And it's this camp, and it has a storied and troubled history. Mm-hmm. And that whole idea of working with the term self-reliance, well, that sounds fun.
Yeah, that was the original title of the book for years, which as I was writing it, and it was decided, Passive Voice, that it was not a good title for the book, which I think in retrospect was correct. But yeah, the reason I was interested in the term self-reliance is because that too, there are so many different ways to kind of use that word in the context of the book. So for those who haven't read it, the Van Laar family, this wealthy family at the center of the book, have a kind of obsession, an intellectual obsession with the transcendentalists, including Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote an essay of the same name called Self-Reliance, which was all about the importance of being completely self-reliant as a human. He cast a lot of aspersion on the idea of needing to rely on anybody else. And the family also named the summer camp down the hill Camp Emerson after him. What a driver points out on the way to this compound, to some visitors, is that the family has this self-conception that they are self-reliant, that all the capital that they've accumulated, all the wealth, they have done so by pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps, by standing on their own 2 feet and doing what they've done. But what they're neglecting to acknowledge is that really, even physically, the house was built by the people of Shattuck, the nearby town. The house is staffed by the people of Shattuck. The camp is staffed by some children of the wealthy, but also by the town of Shattuck. And so the Van Laars are not self-reliant at all. They're reliant really upon the people of their community. And I think not acknowledging that is sort of comes to be part of, without spoiling anything, their downfall. I also think that they have a very limited understanding of what the term self-reliance means. And again, trying not to spoil anything, especially when it comes to women, they don't wish for any of the women in their orbit to be at all self-reliant. And so they prize self-reliance only in a very specific way.
You write about in the history of this camp that they had several successful seasons, even though it operated at a loss. And then the camp's reputation grew within a decade. Camp Emerson, you wrote, became a sought-after destination for the children of well-to-do New Englanders and Manhattanites. Today, most of the participants were the children of friends and acquaintances of the Van Laars. So it sort of lost its luster in a bit and became more of a word-of-mouth place.
Yeah. One thing I was interested in exploring was the impact of wealth, inherited wealth, as opposed to earned wealth. And so there's this figure called, there's a whole bunch of Peters in this book, Peter 1, Peter 2, Peter 3, Peter 4. Peter 1 is the original founder of the preserve. And although I'm not particularly kind to most of the wealthy characters in this book, if I have any kind of understanding of any one of them, it's Peter One, who I think was at least creative and probably would have acknowledged the help of the people who surrounded him from the nearby communities more than perhaps his descendants. But yeah, I think the idea that inherited wealth can like poison subsequent generations is very present in this book, and I think it sort of applies here as well.
Absolutely. Liz Moore is our guest. The name of the new novel is The God of the Woods, and it is published by Riverhead. there are times where you change allegiances here a lot, and by you, I mean the reader will often, I think, I'm saying this for myself, that you think, oh, I don't know if I like this person, mm-hmm. and then you turn around. They're very elastic in their in how they come, and as we learn more about them, and they become more likable and more human, and you understand their place and their lot in life, and that's fascinating to me, especially when you're also exploring this, the haves and the have-nots, and upstairs, downstairs sort of way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, I felt the same way. I did not like a lot of the characters that I was writing as I was first writing them. So Alice, as an example, Alice is the mother of both disappeared children, and she, when she arrived to me, arrived with a kind of obliviousness and a lack of self-awareness of her own luck in life. She's not particularly nice to her staff. She's not actually particularly nice to her daughter. She's very judgmental of her daughter. But as I came to understand her backstory, I found myself having a lot more compassion for her. And I think that also has to do with the very prescribed circumstances of being a wealthy woman born in the generation in which she was born. Her options in life were pretty limited. And I think she suffered because of it. And so, yeah, she became a character who initially I was certain that I wouldn't like very much as a writer. And over the course of the novel, I came to understand her better, at least.
Do you think that, this goes back to an earlier question, do you think much of the success of this book also comes from word of mouth of people who just read it and loved it?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, their word of mouth is hugely important to the way that a book does. Publishing has gotten interesting in the sense that, like many things, I think the options are smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of books that break out. And we could have a whole other interview on that question. A lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of it has to do with like celebrity book clubs or book of the month or, you know, things like that, selecting of only a very few books and those becoming the books that everybody talks about. In my case, the book was selected by Book of the Month, which is a huge help, but it was not, unlike Long Bright River, it was not chosen for one of the major, you know, celebrity book clubs that exist. And so, yeah, we do have to, the book had to rely on word of mouth to a certain extent, and readers who still exist and still talk and still, you know, now more than ever, it seems like, have a very strong online presence as well.
So I asked that question in setting you up just a little bit because one of the things that struck me is I was very scared as I was reading the novel of how it was going to end. Mm-hmm. And again, without giving anything mm-hmm. away, the ending is so fulfilling.
Good.
And to me, that is what makes you want to tell everyone in the world they should read it, because mm-hmm. the ending is so full circle and beautiful.
Thank you.
Many folks don't even get that far, mm-hmm. but to have people to have read it and then love it, and then to then turn to someone and say, you have to read this, mm-hmm. is because of that fullness. I will admit I've got a thing of endings because I read a lot of books and just some of them don't, I think they forgot them.
They don't stick the landing.
They don't end. They just, just stop. Mm-hmm. I walked into the kitchen and yeah. All done.
Yeah. That's funny. Thank you for saying that. Endings are frightening as a writer because, yeah, you can invest so many years into something, and then if the ending just isn't coming to you, or, you know, it can be a frightening feeling. Usually, always, whenever I write a book, I have no idea how it will end, and I just have to go out on a limb and hope that the ending will arrive at some point. And in this case, it probably about, I don't know, two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through a manuscript, a first draft of a manuscript, I started to have a vision of how it would end. And it did require going back and substantially rewriting, which is normal for me. I always have to start over many, many times anytime I write a book. But I did, the minute I saw the ending, I was like, okay, I know what kind of book this is, and I can make it work.
And then you have to market it, and the way it's marketed, I think, is probably different than the way of how what kind of book you thought it was.
Yeah, that has been true for my two most recent books, and probably not coincidentally, those are also the two books of mine that have done the best. So I kind of, at this point, remove myself from the conversation of how a book is marketed, and I leave that to the experts. And Riverhead is the publisher that has published, they published Long Bright River and The God of the Woods, and I just admire them so much. I think they're the best in the business. I think they're great.
Yeah, because sometimes you say, oh, they know what they're doing, and then...
And then they don't.
And they don't,
in this
right.
case, I'm pretty sure, I feel like Riverhead really does. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's good.
Great.
Do you, from start to finish, how long did it take to write this novel?
So I wrote a short story that was published in the magazine Tin House in, I think, either 2012 or 2013, and it was called Shy Shy. Tin House, the magazine, no longer exists. RIP, great magazine. And it was set at a summer camp, and it did feature 12 and 13-year-old girls, but that's about where the similarities ended. But the setting of it really intrigued me, and I returned to it when I was looking for my next novel project after I submitted Long Bright River. So the short answer is it always takes me about 4 years to write the manuscript of a novel in earnest. But really, this many of my books are like percolating in my brain for a lot longer than that, including this one.
Do you have things percolating now, or are mm-hmm. they underway?
They are underway, but I have not yet even talked to my editor about it.
So no.
It is a secret.
The name of the new book is The God of the Woods. It is published by Riverhead. And just the hit of the summer and the fall, and we couldn't be more happy for you and for the success of the book. Liz Moore, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for your great questions.
Great pleasure. Liz Moore's new novel is God of the Woods. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Our thanks to Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs for their production support, and also thanks to the Saratoga Book Festival. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.